Welcome, everyone, to PWN's debut review. I'm Courtney Harler. We're launching season 5 with two wonderful writers, Rebecca Mackay and Megan Lamb. Rebecca is the author of 4 novels and a collection of short stories. Her novel, The Great Believers, was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Her latest novel, I Have Some Questions for You, publishes today from Penguin Random House. Megan has authored several books as well. Her debut novel, Failure to Thrive, launched in 2021, and her latest novel, Coward, published in September of 2022 from Spite and Dival. Megan is also the lead singer of an 80s cinema-inspired band called Kill Scenes. In this first episode of the new season, we talk about how to be a real writer, how to pick the perfect title for your book, how to find strange jobs in strange towns, and how to break the rules. So don't look away. Here are Rebecca Mackay and Megan Lamb. Today, I'm here with Rebecca Mackay and Megan Lamb, both writers now based in Chicago. And I think you two kind of sort of know each other. So tell us about the literary scene in Chicago and how you two know each other and what kind of work you're doing there.
Yeah. So this is Rebecca talking. I am artistic director at a place called Story Studio, which is a nonprofit literary arts writing center, similar to Grub Street, Hugo House, The Loft, those other ones you might know. And Megan has been teaching for us for a while here, but we have not met face to face because of COVID and, you know, everyone hiding at home. I think that's the main reason.
Also, I've been teaching mostly online for Story Studio, in part because of COVID. I also relatively recently moved back to Chicago, lived all over the place for the last decade, but I moved back about a year ago. So, but yeah, I have almost crossed paths with Rebecca on several occasions, but just barely missed her.
We might end up meeting in person tomorrow night at this gathering. So this will be our preliminary conversation. And then we'll see each other and go, I did not think that was what you looked like. And it'll be fun.
Well, I'm glad I could facilitate that. I'm glad I could bring you two together here. And I am very happy to have both of you. I admire both of you and your work so much. One thing that we do is we try to take our guests back to like the beginning of the beginning or before the beginning. It's become kind of a catchphrase, kind of a joke. I think I need to stop saying it. But Rebecca, when did you first realize you'd be a writer? Like, take us all the way back.
I think I'm going to say 7th grade, right when my writing got really bad. You know, like that phase where it's the same era of like, I'm going to take black and white photographs of this cigarette in the gutter and it's going to be really profound. And, you know, everyone goes through a photography phase. And then I hope everyone goes through a writing phase, but it was like right when I was like, I'm going to write a page about nothingness. I'm going to write a page about despair and this bird on the beach, like the worst, you know, most self-serious, sanctimonious writing, but it felt really good. It was expressing my adolescent angst. And then, you know, teachers liked it. And I would get, I think freshman year of high school, my teacher said, oh, you should send this into the lit mag. So that I'd been writing all along. I had loved to write my whole childhood. I would put on plays, make my friends be in them. I would, you know, do the library writing contest. But I didn't identify as a writer. I had other things I wanted to be when I grew up. And then 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, that was like, I shall be a writer, you know, like, and it will be me and Shakespeare in the Pantheon. And then reality came crashing down and, you know, then the rest is all the work.
So tell us a little bit about all the work.
Yeah. I mean, the work is, you know, you write infinite bad stories and, you know, a lot of bad attempts at novels and you figure out what your day job is going to be. And for me, that was teaching Montessori elementary school throughout my 20s, which I loved. And it was a really good, you know, good balance. Like you're around these fascinating small people all day. And, you know, unlike other kinds of teaching, you don't have homework to grade at night. So it was great. But, you know, started publishing stories in my late 20s. And my first novel, The Borrower, came out when I was 31, 32, somewhere in there. 33. I was 33. I can do math. And, you know, the work is the point. The only reason, like the reason that you work so hard is so that you can publish something, so that you can afford to write the next novel. You know, like the reward is you get to do this for a living. So you work so that the reward is work, which sounds sad, except that it's incredibly joyful, fun work, you know?
And then, so The Borrowers was your debut.
The Borrowers is this wonderful children's novel that I did not write about these tiny little people who live in the wall. The Borrower, my novel, is about a children's librarian who accidentally kidnaps a 10-year-old boy. But it has happened on more than one occasion that like someone has done, there was something that was on TV once and someone sent me a clip, some like, you know, PBS thing. Someone was recommending like books for your kids to read this winter. And she said The Borrowers, which is the name of the children's novel. And then they put up a picture of my book and put my name underneath it. And I was like, oh my God, you're telling children to run off and read this book about this like literary novel about a kidnapping. This is really inappropriate and hilarious.
Well, you know, it was a benevolent kidnapping, but not quite yet.
Not really a children's novel.
No, not a children's novel at all. You know, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that there was that conflation going on out there in the world. That's hilarious. So I was going to follow your trajectory a little bit here. So we have The Borrower, and then we have The 100-Year House.
No, The 100-Year House. And
The 100-Year House. Gosh, Rebecca, I'm so sorry.
No. Courtney, if I didn't know you, I would be sitting here being like, yes, and being awkward. But I feel like I can, you know, but this happens. It happens with every single book title. I don't know. Maybe I think it's not just me because I posted about this on Twitter once and everyone's like, yeah, here are all the ways people say that there's always a way. Anyway, no, it's The 100-Year House is the next one. That was a novel.
No one in there. Yep. So The Borrower. Yep. The Borrower is your first novel. And then 100-Year House, second novel.
And then Music for Wartime was my story collection.
Yep, which is a collection of short stories. Yep. And then The Believers, which blew up.
Yeah, The Great Believers came out in 2018.
Great Believers. Gosh, Rebecca, I'm sorry. You're going to have to excuse my COVID brain.
It is COVID brain. We know this. No, it's very funny because this happens every single time. And also I get for The Great Believers, I also get The True Believers, which makes it sound religious, and which it's not.
Right.
But there's also my new book that's coming out in February is called I Have Some Questions for You. And my mom on the phone, she was like, so this book, it sounds exciting. It's called I Need to Ask You Something. I was like, oh God, no. It's starting. My own mother.
I think this is interesting. It could be an interesting discussion about titles because I'm clearly remembering them. Like, I guess, you know, my brain's just latching on to like the main words, but you know, these choices are very specific and deliberate on your part and you know, the part of your editor and your publisher. Do you have anything to like impart about titles? Like they're fraught, aren't they? They're kind of fraught.
They are. Here's the thing. Yeah. There's one way in which I am extremely lucky, which is my last name. It is unusual. People remember having seen it. They might see it just once and then remember having seen it. Whereas if your name is Dave Smith, like how many times does someone need to see that name before it clicks, right? It's got a double K. It's an unusual spelling, but it's not a long name that people can't remember how to spell. I mean, people do still mangle it, but like it. So if someone, you know, I think titles matter. They definitely matter. If someone could still Google my name and maybe even misspell it and maybe type in, you know, I need to ask you something instead of I have some questions for you. And they're still going to find it. which is really helpful in the bookstore, on Google, whatever, right? Whereas, you know, I have friends who are wonderful writers and they have, you know, just much more common names that are much more common in the US, right? And it's hard, but they, I mean, a title, God, it's, I think the only, my only two books that kept, that they actually were published under the title that I had for them all along were The Great Believers and Music for Wartime. Everything else was like a last minute title change, trying to get something that really telegraphed the meaning of the book and, you know, would work on a cover and wasn't the same as something else that was already out there. So, stories are easier because you can kind of, you know, find some weird, cool phrase, but a book title, you got to think about how it looks. You got to think about if it's memorable. You got to think about if it expresses the tone of the thing. You got to be ready to say it a million times, you know, as you publicize it. So it's tricky business.
I imagine I Have Some Questions for You is going to be a mouthful in all your upcoming interviews as well.
It's also going to be, people are going to make a joke about it every single time. You know, like when I sit down for an interview, no one can resist. And it comes up, like my editor will email me and be like, I have a few questions for you. Oh God, LOL, I didn't mean to do that. You know, the phrase that people say all the time, but I'm ready to roll with it. I'm ready for the puns.
I'm going to resist. I'm going to resist because in my COVID brain, it just actually occurred to me. Sorry, I didn't even pick up on that. Okay, so speaking of your new novel, like what made you pivot more toward literary mystery this time? I think all your books have a little bit of mystery to them, but this is more of a definitive pivot toward literary mystery. What inspired that shift?
The closest I think I came before, The 100-Year House certainly has, you know, has ghosts and kind of a haunted house and that vibe. This is a murder mystery. It is literary. You know, this is, this is not your cozy weekend mystery read, right? But there is a murder. And by the end of the book, you are pretty sure you know who did it. And first of all, I like that kind of book. I'm always looking for, I often pick up books that are kind of in that mystery / literary territory, wanting them to be something that they sometimes are not. I often either want them to be more literary, or so often it's like a literary novel that they're kind of marketing as like, oh, and there's a murder and it's a mystery. And it's like, oh, you mean this murder that barely gets mentioned in chapter 3 and then no one ever solves? Like, come on, man, what a mystery. So it's definitely, I mean, and of course there are, you know, some brilliant ones out there, but it's, you know, it's a lot of write the book that you want to read. And I have lived on campus at a boarding school for the past 21 years. This is the boarding school where my husband teaches outside Chicago. And it was inevitable that I was going to write a boarding school novel at some point in my career. This was the one that came out. I didn't want to write a YA novel, you know, and I didn't want to write about kids. So you end up writing about adults. You end up then thinking about adults who are reckoning with the past, revisiting the past. And when you're writing about the past, mystery is a, you know, of some kind is sort of an obvious place to go. When we have unanswered questions about the past, that's what mystery is. Unanswered questions about the present, that would be confusion or intrigue, I guess. Unanswered questions about the future, that's suspense. It's what keeps most books going. But unanswered questions about the past is mystery. So dealing with this question of, you know, adults revisiting their own adolescence, mystery of some kind was always going to be at the core.
All right. So Megan, I'll ask you the same question. What first inspired you to write?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I know how to answer what first inspired me to write. Listening to Rebecca's answer, I will say that I went through my own writer phase around the same age where I was writing about dead birds, or I think in fourth grade, I wrote a poem modeled after Edgar Allan Poe that was a haiku that was like dead mare in pouring rain. My teacher sent me to the principal's office, and I thought she was sending me to the principal's office because she was so proud of my awesome poem, but she was actually sending me to the principal's office because she was disturbed about me. Perhaps that could be thought of as a kind of beginning and that I never really grew out of, but I don't think I really thought of myself as a writer until my senior year of undergrad, when I was in a communication and culture, like a rhetoric and media studies class at Indiana University, where I went to undergrad. For the final project in this class, we had to write an ethnography. I think it was where we examined three different generations of our family, or maybe that was just the approach that I chose to take. But I wrote like a really weird experimental, or what my instructor identified as a piece of experimental fiction. I just thought I was writing an ethnography that engaged with a fairy tale that had been told through multiple generations in my family. But she gave me some recommendations for places to send it and a list of places that I might look into. And I sent my work out to, I think, like 33 different places in that first round, and I ended up getting it published in one of them. That was the first story I published. But I think the reason I think of that as me becoming a real writer is because that was my first time sending something out in the world and dealing with mass rejection, which I think of as being kind of the essential experience of being a writer. Dealing with rejection and pushing through it and saying to yourself, no, what I'm doing is worth.
Well, you know, for those of us who don't have a book out yet, it's still a daily exercise in humility, getting those rejections back in. And it's always like, you know, getting something published or something recognized is always such a big push forward too. You learn to kind of let the rejections roll off your back like a, you know, water off a duck, but the wins are really, really useful. So where was that initial win for you, Megan? Where was that first publication?
Oh, I'm a little embarrassed to say it's in a now defunct magazine that doesn't exist anymore, but it was in a magazine called Prick of the Spindle. They published a lot of fairy tale-ish fiction, or fiction that interacted with fairy tales. So I think that's why they were interested in it.
So your book, your first book, Megan, was Failure to Thrive. Did I get that title right? Am I getting...
Yeah. Well, and it also it depends on what you consider a first book. I had a short story collection published a year before that, and I had a novella published in 2017, but they didn't get the greatest distribution. So I guess my first book that was a novel that got any kind of attention was Failure to Thrive.
Okay. Yeah, that's the first that I'm familiar with, because we did that interview with the Master's Review, which was great fun. And at the Master's Review, they do tend to pick up, you know, interviews with debut novelists. So that's probably why you and I connected from the start. But you have a new novel out too called Coward. I have it here in my hands. It's a little novel. How is that going from Failure to Thrive to Coward? We're only about a year later. When did Failure to Thrive drop? It was just last year, right?
Yes. During the pandemic.
Yep. And Coward just launched a few months ago, right?
Last month. It was actually kind of a surprise. My press had told me, okay, when you have all your materials in, it'll be about a 3-month out process before the book is released. But I don't know if it was that my materials were more ready or I misunderstood what had been communicated to me, but I proofed my copy that I had and sent it in, and I already had everything else ready to go. And then a week later, they sent me a link to my book and said it was ready to purchase. It was kind of like, there was no pre-order process or anything. It was just like, boop, your book's ready. And I kind of panicked because I didn't really have that great of a publicity strategy because I thought I still had a couple more months. Mm. And nobody knew it was coming out.
This is a very small press, right?
This is a pretty small press, but it's actually, ironically, the largest press they've published with.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Okay. So I'm thinking like that's small presses have so much incredible, first of all, they do have a tremendous amount of power in terms of, you know, the voices that get out there. They have this flexibility in terms of what they publish, in terms of taste. They publish amazing stuff. And then the process of publishing, the publicity part of it is so different, I think, than what a lot of people expect, because what they've heard about is big publishing, right? Where it's like a year of wind up. And I think people are, I have a lot of friends who are sort of surprised then by that kind of process. But I mean, it looks like they did a beautiful job with the book. It looks gorgeous. I'm, you know, excited to pick this one up. Are you happy with how the book, you know, is, how it looks, how it exists in the world?
I am very happy with how it turned out, layout-wise and image-wise. My friend Devin Stakonis, who I met when I was living in Pennsylvania working on Failure to Thrive. Well, I had originally asked her to do the art for the cover because she was planning to do this series of close-up drawings of corpses in the morgue, like super close-up, so the flesh was almost abstracted, so it looked like landscapes. And there's a lot of weird bleeness between the body and the landscape within which it is housed in this book, and I guess in all of my books. So I said, like, yeah, that would be a really cool idea for a cover or even like illustrations to interact in an unexpected way with the text. And she didn't end up being allowed to do that project. But when she was visiting me, she had talked about wanting to do more life drawings. So I said, here, you can just draw me as a corpse. So that was kind of how the cover happened. It is me on the cover. It's created an interesting situation with promoting it, where, like, I didn't really like think through the ramifications of having myself nude on a cover as much as I probably should have. But I, when it kind of dropped suddenly and unexpectedly, I didn't know. Like, I feel pretty comfortable promoting it on Instagram or social media that I know my family doesn't go to, but I still don't know if my mother has seen the cover of my book, and I want to control the situation wherein she sees it if she ends up seeing it.
Oh my God, that is I mean, we think so much about, you know, like, what if my in-laws read this, right? Like this scene, this sex scene, this relationship, whatever, you know, what if, you know, my first grade teacher reads this, but actually literally seeing the book being the scary part. That's amazing. Oh my God.
Reading the book being what is also the scary part. I will not lie, but yeah, this is my first time dealing with something questionable being right on the very cover of the book.
Incredible.
Do you think it will be like immediately apparent to your friends and family that that's you?
Well, with anyone who knows me well enough to know that I have a tattoo on my forearm that you can kind of identify in the picture.
Yeah, you can see it for sure. All right. Well, that's an interesting fact I did not know.
Now you know.
It really is. It really is lovely, though. It's a really gorgeous cover and book. And speaking of which, I would like to ask both of you to read for us, if you'd like to, from either from your latest work or something else that you would like to read. You guys can pick who goes first.
Ooh, I think Megan should, since we were just talking about it. I want to hear from it.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned to you before, Courtney, and I guess you by proxy, Rebecca, I'd like to give a bit of a soft content warning. There is some gore and disturbing material. And it's also based on a real story. And I'll just leave you with that curiosity. He goes to the address Dwayne gave, which takes him to an outdoor coffee stand with two small plastic tables with small plastic chairs. He sits in one and waits. Two kids who look too young to be there by themselves are sitting at the other, coloring a stack of books. Not coloring books, but a stack of regular print novels, which he notices all have library barcodes on the side. Meanwhile, of course, the atmosphere is wrong. The sky is still black, still smells of burning, and the air is thick with smog. A man who must be Dwayne pulls up and parks his motorcycle. Dwayne has shoulder-length gray hair, half bundled in a messy bun. Dwayne shakes his hand, but doesn't make eye contact as he does. He sits across from him and doesn't order anything. So, as I said, Dwayne says, this job is for someone to help with pickups, which take place in hospitals, old folks' homes, houses, trailers, sometimes open fields, any time of day or night. You never know, of course. And that is why we need someone who's flexible. By pickups, what do you mean? I mean, what exactly are we picking up? He asks. Although somehow he knows already. That is why he came. Dwayne says, dead bodies. Yeah, dead bodies, he repeats, using a whisper hiss that's louder than the voice that he was using. The kids don't seem to hear, and if they do, they don't care. They sit silent at their tables, scrawling with their broken crayons. What do we pick them up in? He asks. I mean, in what kind of vehicle? A van, says Dwayne. A black van. It's my van. And is there training? What is that like? He asks. First time it's a ride along, says Dwayne. You know, to see if this is something you would want to do. Dwayne pauses. Is this something you would want to do? He says, maybe. I think I need to know more. Dwayne slowly nods, like he has had this conversation many times. Most people probably don't make it past this part. He feels a twinge of pride that he has made it past this part. He feels shivers of some dread excitement prickling the insides of his chest, his neck, like loose internal threads, the scraping scribbles of the broken crayons becomes the shifting of these threads, the rhythm of his thoughts. What do you need to know? Dwayne asks, using a tone of studied calm. I don't know. Everything? Like, how do I know when there is a pickup? I will call you, Dwayne says calmly. I will give you 1 hour's notice. I will say, pick up downtown, in the city, in the country. I will tell you if it is a natural death, suicide, or accident. He pauses. Or if it is something else. What do you mean by something else? He asks. He feels a shiver creeping in his throat and wishes that he'd ordered something from the stand. I mean, Dwayne leans in, looks over his shoulder at the kids, and whisper hisses. Sometimes they are not whole bodies, if you know what I mean. Sometimes someone will report a hand, a leg, some kind of part or parts that they found decomposing in a field. And so we have to kind of gather them. Dwayne pinches his hand through the air in front of him, gathering invisible parts. What do we use to pick up parts? He asks. Bags, Dwayne says. Big black bags, you know, with zippers. And I use gloves, vinyl gloves, because I have a latex allergy. Some people like to wear a mask, but I don't wear one. You get used to smells. You just build up a tolerance. "What do you wear for pickups?" he asks, picturing hazmat suits, plastic ponchos, meat aprons, and face shields, some kind of protection. Dwayne looks down and thinks about it. "Maybe like a polo shirt? Some khakis?" He cannot imagine Dwayne wearing a pair of khakis. Dwayne's voice gets lower. "Now, I need to level with you. In this job, you will get blood on you, and bits of skin, and bits of people's insides, bits of brain. You will see splattered bits. You will see death of all kinds and decay of all kinds. Maggots. You will see dead babies." The two crayon scribbling kids perk up at the sound of dead babies. They look at one another, snort, laugh, scurry off to who the fuck knows where. They are alone now, him and Dwayne, here at their plastic table, underneath the black sky, surrounded on all sides by soon-to-be deaths. Dwayne still has not made any eye contact. He looks down at the ground on his left side like he is watching something crawling in the dirt. Slick strands of gray hair hang over his eyes, concealing them. Thick beads of sweat drip, likely darkening the same spot. "I need to tell you about my first ride along," Dwayne says. "The call came, and they said it was a suicide. They said a guy had killed himself at home in his garage inside his car. So I was picturing a simple cleanup, figuring he'd close the door and gassed himself. I got there, and I saw these cop cars in his driveway, red lights flashing, saw the people moving in and out of his house in the dark. I thought, why do they need so many people for a guy who killed himself like that, alone in his garage? And then I saw why. For some reason, he had sat down in his driver's seat and blown his brains out, you know, with a gun there in his car. His face was not a face. There was this shell of what had been a face. Like, from the left side, if you looked in through the window in the dark, it was a face still. On the left side, he still had one eye, one ear, some hair, and even enough jaw there that the face still had a face shape. But on the right side, and if you looked in then through the windshield, you would see this blast of bloody flesh and tissue, just this cape of splattered mess. And it did something to me, seeing someone's face like that. This splattered mess just sitting there on top of normal shoulders, arms, and chest. It was the strangest thing helping to haul him out, shifting his arms and shoulders, feeling all these whole and normal muscles in my hands, then looking up every so often and just seeing that. And I looked up because the bits, the flecks of muscle, fat, and brain, would drip down on my face as I was moving him around. I even got a bit of bloody brain inside my mouth at one point. "You learn to keep your mouth closed at this job, I'll tell you that." Dwayne makes a weird laugh that does not sound like a laugh. Dwayne doesn't talk for what feels like a long and heavy moment, which he needs. He shuts his eyes, imagines flap skin, shards of bone, red sludge, pink-yellow flecks of fat, stiff shoulders, dead weight, arms beneath. He would be wearing a red flannel shirt, he thinks. Yes, he feels sure of this. Small drips of red blood blending in amidst the flannel, sticky froths among the carpet crusted on the ceiling. Drips of brain. Oh, God. A dark metallic flavor fills his mouth. He runs his tongue around the insides of his cheeks, the sour slicks of his teeth, tastes it. Yes, the warm, cold, weird, wet shocks of recognition,
someone else's insides on the outside, suddenly, now suddenly, inside of him. He can imagine all of this and feel all of this with such ease that he thinks, God, I could do this. I'd be good at this. So how much does it pay? He asks. It's $30 for a pickup, Dwayne says. $30 an hour? No, for the whole pickup. And how many of those do you do, like in a normal week? Dwayne shrugs. You never know. Sometimes none. Sometimes there'll be dozens. In times like these, the heat, the fire, you get a lot of calls. Old folks and junkies dying. He points at the black sky. 'Tis the season. He finds himself saying, I'd like to do a ride-along. Dwayne nods. I had a feeling about you. So now the only thing I need here is a background check. Dwayne passes him a grainy one-page form that looks like it's been recopied for several decades. It takes less than 30 seconds to fill out the whole thing. Dwayne takes it, nods again. Well, you'll be hearing from me. As Dwayne remounts his motorcycle, brushes back his hair, he finally makes eye contact. His eyes are milky blue. One more thing, Dwayne says. I don't say this to be morbid, but I really love my job. I really do love what I do.
That's incredible. Well, oh my God, I'm so hushed.
Yeah, it's chilling too, isn't it?
And it's a true story.
Yeah, oh my God.
Thank you for joining us for season 5 of PWN's Debut Review. This podcast is hosted by Project Right Now, a nonprofit writing studio. We would love for you to become part of our vibrant community of writers. As a gift for listening, please use the code DEBUT for 10% off a virtual class. You can learn more about all of our classes, workshops, and events at projectrightnow.org. That's right, WRITE, projectrightnow.org. Thank you so much.
You know, I wondered about that, about when I was reading it, about scenes like this. I didn't realize that there was probably some outside contractor who may come in to help with this kind of scene. I always thought it was just something that the police or the authorities did. But if this is based on a true story, there's a lot more involved there than I realized.
I would certainly hope that most situations aren't as sketchy as this one. I can tell you the whole story if you're curious, if this is the time for that.
I am actually really super curious. Are you curious, Rebecca?
Yes. So when I was living in Spokane, my now ex-husband was looking for work, and he was looking for kind of liminal short-term work that he didn't have to commit to in the long term because we weren't exactly how long we were going to be there. So he was looking on Craigslist for just random odd jobs. And this job came up for, I think it was just listed as medical transport. So we thought, based on like the very little information in the ad, that maybe it was for being a medical courier where you're like driving medical supplies around, or maybe like transporting fluids, like blood samples or something. And the most gruesome assumption we have was that maybe it was transporting bodies from the morgue of the hospital or some facility to the funeral home. What it turned out to be was much like this interview situation, he called about the job and they set up an interview at a Starbucks outside. And the guy showed up on his motorcycle, much like Dwayne does. And they had this
weird conversation just at a Starbucks. And
just as he says in the end, it was $30 for a pickup, and it was very ill-specified what a pickup was. I was like, and as he was narrating all of this to me, like, obviously I wasn't there for any of this interview. I asked him, like, how long is a pickup? He's like, well, he said it could be anywhere from an hour to maybe 4 or 5 or 6 hours. He was like, so you're getting paid less than minimum wage to pick up parts of dead bodies that you might find in a field, or like, that's not enough for the therapy that you'd have to go through after witnessing something like that, or whatever. Like, it's not enough to unsmell the smells you'd smell and like pay for the dry cleaning. Like, there's myriad things. But yeah, at least in Spokane, Washington, if you're looking for jobs on Craigslist, this is apparently a job that exists in the world. And he had wanted to do a drive along just to see what the job would be like. I think he was even interested in doing it. And I said, no, you don't. Something's going to happen if you do something like that, and it's not going to be a good thing. And I think that's where a lot of my impetus to write this book came from, was just my curiosity about the kind of person who would be interested in doing this job, and the kind of dread that would build thinking about doing that ride along.
I used to live in Spokane as well, outside Spokane in Cheney. And it is a strange town in some ways, but I never knew it was this strange, to be honest. Is this in conjunction with the authorities at all, or is this just a separate, this is just a gig thing?
He said that there are police there, and the way he put it is, you'll be glad to have them there, because a lot of the times, if you're removing someone from the home who's died, or like interacting in any way with the family, like, they'll be aggressive toward you. Like, we've had people who have attacked us as we tried to remove their loved one from the home. Yeah, $30 a pickup.
Gosh. Yeah. So dangerous and potentially traumatic in many ways. Very, yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for that very beautiful but chilling reading, Megan. It's that I remember feeling, you know, the chills and the goosebumps when I first read it as well, but to hear it in your voice is such a treat for our listeners. Rebecca, would you like to read something spooky as well?
Sure. Mine's a little dark too. You know, I'm going to read it. This will be really short. I'm just going to read the prologue of this book, which is not labeled as a prologue, because, you know, if you labeled it as a prologue, no one would read it. So it just happens, and then there's a part one. But this is just like a page and a half. This is the opening of I Have Some Questions for You, which is the new novel. You've heard of her, I say, a challenge, an assurance. To the woman on the neighboring hotel bar stool who's made the mistake of striking up a conversation. To the dentist who runs out of questions about my kids and asks what I've been up to myself. Sometimes they know her right away. Sometimes they ask, wasn't that the one where the guy kept her in the basement? No, it was not. Wasn't it the one where she was stabbed in? No. The one where she got in a cab with different girl. The one where she went to the frat party. The one where he used a stick. The one where he used a hammer. The one where she picked him up from rehab and he, no. The one where he'd been watching her jog every day. The one where she made the mistake of telling him her period was late. The one with the uncle. Wait, the other one with the uncle? No, it was the one with the swimming pool. The one with the alcohol, with the hair around, with the guy who confessed to, right, yes. They nod, comforted. By what? My barstool neighbor pulls the celery from her Bloody Mary, crunches down. My dentist asks me to rinse. They work her name in their mouths, their memories. I definitely know that one, they say. That one. Because what is she now but a story? A story to know or not know. a story with a limited set of details, a story to master by memorizing maps and timelines. The one from the boarding school, they say. I remember, the one from the video. You knew her? She's the one whose photo pops up if you search New Hampshire murder, alongside mugshots from the meth-addled tragedies of more recent years. One photo, her laughing with her mouth but not her eyes, suggesting some deep unhappiness, tends to feature in clickbait. It's only a cropped shot of the tennis team from the yearbook. If you knew Thalia, it's easy enough to see she wasn't actually upset, was just smiling for the camera when she didn't feel like it. It was the story that got told and retold. It was the one where she was young enough and white enough and pretty enough and rich enough that people paid attention. It was the one where we were all young enough to think someone smarter had the answers. Maybe it was the one we got wrong. Maybe it was the one we all collectively, each bearing only the weight of a feather, got wrong. So that's the prologue, and then there's part one, but we'll stop there.
Nice, nice. What I love about this non-prologue is that you get the reader right in there. The reader sort of feels like they're sort of everywhere all at once. Mm-hmm. Like past and present, and you're at the dentist or you're at the bar. I love that feeling. I love that like expansiveness there. It's very speculative, but also kind of grounding, like, because I immediately imagine being at a bar next to someone drinking a Bloody Mary with celery sticks, you know, and then mm-hmm. the dentist is such a familiar experience as well, but yet it's defamiliarized in that it's about a murder, which, you know, I haven't personally experienced, but yet I'm enthralled by it, you know, the idea of the murder, and then just this feel in the line, or in the flow of the line of being everywhere all at once. I got that feeling very much from The Great Believers as well, because, you know, you go back and forth in time, mm-hmm. but also like being in one time, but also still being in the other time, right? Because the characters are so striking and memorable, and you're like, part of your heart is still with them. And then, you know, you go into the future, and then, you know, so this happens in this book as well. And, you know, we don't want to give too much away, but people can get the book today if they haven't pre-ordered it already. Do you want to speak to that technique a little bit, Rebecca?
Yeah. Like, I totally can.
It's just something that you just do so well. It's just like this all encompassing like spanning of time and space and perspective.
Thanks. Yeah, I think all of my work is concerned with time. I mean, you know, everyone's work is concerned with time because it's the passage of time, et cetera. But it really is a preoccupation, I think, of my work. The 100-Year House, my second novel, went backwards in time. The Great Believers, like you said, toggles between the 80s and 2015. This one is, you know, it's really set in 2018 and then 2022, but it's someone looking back on 1995. And I think it's one of those things that for me, a story starts to come alive when there's sort of a three-dimensionality to time in it. I just try to write one small, you know, a linear story that doesn't have echoes of the past or the future or speak to other time periods. It can work for me. I certainly have some short stories like that, but so often what makes the story start to just ping, you know, everything off each other, this echo chamber kind of effect, is the idea of echoes of time and the passage of time. It's tricky, you know, that prologue, you know, existing kind of everywhere and nowhere, like you said, that's risky. It's the kind of thing that I wouldn't always, I'm often, you know, cautioning my students against, because—
I was just going to say, Rebecca, it's the kind of thing my students are always trying to do and not quite doing successfully.
Right. It's hard because, you know, I think you certainly, you know, when I was younger, if I'd tried something like this, what would have happened would have been, you know, like, we're just disoriented. We're not grounded in anything. You know, the main thing, you open a book, I want to know where I am and what's happening. Orient me to this world, because you're asking me to go on a 300-page journey with you. I need to know what's happening. And I'm breaking all of my own rules here, where I'm saying, you know, I'm at the dentist, I'm at the bar, I'm not. It wasn't this story, and it wasn't this story. And it, like, let's talk about all the things it wasn't. And then I'm barely going to tell you what it was. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll see if you know, if that works, if I get away with it, or if people pick up the book and are like, I don't know what's going on, and put it down. I think one reason I was okay letting myself do that is that that is only a page and a half. And then immediately after that, we are in a very specific place and time. And this woman is lying in bed looking at an iPad, and we know exactly what's going on. So, you know, as a prologue, it's like, just bear with me for a tiny second, and then we'll be zoomed in and oriented. But, you know, the reason I wanted it like that, the reason that that came to me, it certainly wasn't the first thing I wrote, but the reason that that was added there for me was that it does introduce that feeling of, wait, you know, I know where I am in time, but I'm not, you know, but I don't live in the present. I know what story this is, but all these other stories start to encroach. And do we really know what happened? Do we mix it up with other things that happened that we think could have happened, the stories we want to tell? I should add, I think that so often when an opening is really, really vague and ungrounded, it's because it was the first thing someone wrote and they didn't know their own story yet. And it's them feeling around. I think this worked for me because I'd written most of the novel. I knew what was happening, and I could go back and be like, no, I want this. I want this weird grace note at the beginning. I want this sort of this pickup beat to the novel that it's not me floundering. it's me, you know, intentionally going, okay, here's what we're in for.
Yeah, it felt absolutely intentional to me. And it, like I said, it sort of grounded me and disoriented me at the same time, which had the effect of intriguing me and making me want to read more and more. I think it, you know, as they say in workshop, like, it taught me how to read the book. Like, this, you need to be willing for there to be a lot of uncertainty as you move through this literary mystery. And I was all about it. I was all for it. So, I'm glad you read that part. Yeah. I think it's like it's a perfect unnamed prologue for the book.
Yeah. It does a good job of teaching the reader what kinds of information they can expect to get and what kinds of information that they should expect to still have questions about.
I appreciate this because, you know, I know this is airing in February, but we're recording this in October when I'm still like, I don't know what's going to happen, if people are going to like this book and I don't know what's going on. So, you know, reading it out loud and having people not like fall asleep is very helpful and reassuring.
Yeah. So we're in the unique case here, in that I know sort of when, you know, we're planning to drop this episode, but we don't always know that in advance. So some of our episodes do have this kind of like time warpy feel. And then some of them I try to pretend like, oh, it's on this day. But I think, you know, listeners will see through that facade. So this part may even stay in. So listeners, you know, we're kind of back in October now and things are still happening. So we'll see what the editor does with this material. Wonderful readings from both of you. We'll move in to the last segment, which we call the mood board segment. And we had some great moods in those readings, great tones and settings. I'll start with you, Rebecca, first. Like, this is the part where we ask you, like, what keeps you inspired? What keeps you writing? Like, what helps you find and like follow through with that next big novel or short story idea? Is it like other books or films or TV or food or exercise or whatever it is that keeps you pushing forward? What is it for you that just keeps your creativity flowing?
I mean, I don't tend to struggle with that. It's, you know, I have too many ideas. Usually I have, you know, I know what I think my next five books are at this point. I probably won't get to them all. I'll probably change my mind, but I'm like, I've got these planned. I want to work on them. I'm like, you know, dying to work on them. It's more about, for me, it's about what gets in my way, which is at this point, just the daily business of being a writer, of teaching writing, the emails, the inbox, you know, my schedule. It's, you know, for me, I have realized, especially this fall, it's kind of hit sort of a breaking point with me of, I have to protect my writing time because especially when if I'm far in a project, if I'm editing, I can squeeze it in and do 10 minutes of editing and then go do something else, you know, in that moment that I have. When it's something new, I need, you know, long swaths of protected time. And before the pandemic, I did a lot of writing residencies, places like Yaddo, Ragdale, UCross, going for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks and just working. And that all fell apart with COVID. And, you know, I certainly got this book done, but I, you know, have not thought far enough out to apply for places like that, you know, coming up in the future. I need to be better about that. So basically my default mode is creative, if that makes sense. I go for a walk. Like I went for a walk this morning, I got my coffee and I went for a walk and I'm thinking about many different things, but a lot of what I'm thinking about is stuff that I want to write, things, you know, the project I'm working on now, project, you know, ideas for 17 new projects, weird details. It's like, you know, when everything else falls away, that is my absolute default mode. The problem is the noise on top of that, you know, but I have to drive to the city today to do this thing. I have a meeting and then, you know, like, and it's fine. It's good. But, So basically it's sort of a non-answer, but for me, it's, you know, default gear, you know, is writing, is creative, is thinking about writing or doing the writing. And of course, writing does not equal typing. Writing can be going for a walk and brainstorming and thinking about it. Writing can be outlining, writing can be research and clearing, you know, clearing the noise, clearing the stuff, coming to terms with the fact that I'm never going to like reach inbox zero and I can't sit down and go, well, I'll just answer all my emails first and then I'll start to write. But I have to actually go, okay, no, this is, you know, all day I'm doing nothing but writing. And that's the important thing for me.
How much time are you able to carve out, say, per day for a new project?
Right. I mean, like,
I know, a funny, you know, question. I know.
Yeah. And yeah. This is the thing too. It's like, my days are not all the same. I, you know, COVID was a break in this, but I travel a ton for, you know, just the business of being a writer. It's a, you know, either a paid or an unpaid reading somewhere. It's a festival, it's a conference. So, you know, there are days, there are weeks that go by that I don't do anything. And then there are days when I might be able to write for, you know, 3 or 4 hours. You know, this past week, I was on hand story studio. My studio in Chicago had a half day writing retreat. I was there. I went on it. I was able to sit there and work on two different new projects. Just, you know, kind of worked on one before lunch, worked on one after lunch. That was like last Saturday. I haven't written anything since, which is not great. So it's not, I am not someone who stands by a quote unquote writing routine. I think that comes from sometimes a very privileged place of like, yes, my writing routine. I go to my cabin and my wife leaves my lunch outside my door and I write every day, even on Christmas. I excuse myself to my family. Okay, man. Great. Good for you. you know, I have to be able to like write on the airport floor or not write for a week and then get back into it. I think that when people hold this idea of a writing routine as this precious thing in their heads, like it's rarely going to happen. And then you're going to be like, well, I can't write because I haven't, you know, I'm not in my special place with my special tea at the special time. And you're going to screw yourself over, you know?
Yeah. I hear this concept of noise. I hear it so much myself. I'm sure you have a lot of competing thoughts and projects in your mind too, Megan.
I was wondering if I could ask a question to Rebecca, and I guess
please. I have a question for you, but I would love for you to ask Rebecca a question as well.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like in those periods of latency where you aren't typing writing, what do you do to keep yourself engaged with the world of what what you're working on, even when you're not like actually sitting down to work on it. I write a lot of lists. The class that I taught for the Stories Studio Fall Festival, and I've taught through a couple different entities, was all about narrative lists and lists as a form of narrative organizing ethos. But yeah, it was amazing. Like, people sat there and for the 5 minutes they had to write, they turned out amazing material. Like, I don't usually have, I don't know, the list seems to inspire people to generate in the moment like no other form, because it's just such a natural thing for people to do. But yeah, I'm obsessed with lists, and I'm curious about what you have that is maybe like a non-literary form of writing, or something that you do when you're not typing out the actual pages.
That's really cool. I'm going to try the list thing, because that sounds amazing. It depends. You know, there are times when it's research. I have some questions for you. Was a much less research heavy book than something like The Great Believers, which was, you know, it was the AIDS epidemic in Chicago. I had historical, medical, legal, psychological research to do constantly. And with The Great Believers, it was also, you know, I was reading books about AIDS. I was watching films. I was meeting with people, interviewing them. So it was just constantly going on. I have some questions for you. The main research I needed to do was about the New Hampshire legal system. And that was a bit more contained, except, you know, in this case, I'm writing about a boarding school. I live on campus at a boarding school. So I'm walking around, you know, in the setting, and set in a very different place. It's set in New Hampshire, very different school, but still that idea of, you know, I'm at a boarding school. With other ones, you know, sometimes it is research. I'm about to be in late October, early November. I'm going to be in Europe, in Austria and Germany, to do some research for either my next book or the one after that. I'm not sure, you know, the order. I'm hoping that, you know, just being there, I'm going to be able to, you know, not only take notes, but start to write. But sometimes that research for me is like, you know, it's Googling stuff. It's ordering the Sears catalog off of eBay for the year that I'm writing about, you know? So like, it's pretty cool. You can get it for like $50 to $100, you know, 1955 Sears catalog, 1929 Sears catalog. You can find literally everything that was available to buy that year and what it was called and how much it cost. It's really fun.
My partner, Robert Kloss, does a lot of research like this. He's a member of the Oak Park River Forest Historic Society, and he spends a lot of time just going through old ads there.
Yes, totally, totally. So research is one thing. Another thing is just, you know, like it's always there. It's always below the surface. So when I let myself, you know, I have to remind myself that like, I don't always need to be listening to an audiobook or a podcast when I'm driving or walking. If I can just go on a walk without my AirPods in, I will end up working. I will end up thinking about the project at hand or about a new project or just having some thought that'll, you know, come into my work at some point, you know, and jotting down notes constantly. But I wish I had some kind of really cool writing exercise, you know, like the list thing. But, you know, occasionally it's music, that there will be some, you know, some song that I associate strongly with a book, and listening to that will get me back into it. The really weird thing for The Great Believers, it's a song that it has not, you know, it's mentioned in the book, but it really has nothing to do with the exact era of the book. But the Simon and Garfunkel's America from their Central Park concert, which would have been way before my book started, that became the song that when I listened to that, I could get back into the book. And I put it in there as a song that's being played at a memorial service right at the beginning of the story. And it got to the point where the song would make me cry, and I'd like watch the video of the Central Park concert. This has nothing to do with AIDS in Chicago. And it just, but that one song would get me completely back in that zone.
I love that you mentioned music, Rebecca, because Megan is also a musician.
Yes.
yeah, you have a band, Megan, and I'd love for you to tell us all about it. You were recently on Large Hearted Boy to share Coward's playlist too. So I imagine that, you know, music plays an important role in your overall creative process. Would you like to talk about that and maybe how music and writing intertwine or intersect in your process?
Oh, gosh. Yes, I would. I'm actually doing an interview with Jeff Jackson, or kind of different segments of an interview that is different interviews. It's kind of amorphous at this point, but he is in a band called Julian Calendar, and he's my other most prominent writer friend who has written a lot peripherally about music and is in a band, but actually, like, most of the time, he was writing about music. He was using his experience as a playwright and director and kind of how that's portable to music, because he wasn't in a band at the time. Anyway, but that's all a different conversation to look forward to. Yeah, it's a really good question. I'm still kind of like working my way around that question in the course of like the conversations I'm having with Jeff, but music is one of those touchstones for me, similarly to you, Rebecca, or it sounds like with what you do. It's a way to touch back into the world of what I'm writing, even when I'm not sitting down and actively working on it. And my playlist that I had for, I actually do make a literal playlist usually for everything that I write, and tracks will come and go from that playlist. But the playlist that I had for Large Hearted Boy was basically what I would listen to in my iTunes whenever I was trying to get back into the world of the book. And some of them were songs that were on my playlist. Some of them were songs that I remembered. Well, in the case of this book, a lot of it is about being a teenager, going into AOL chat rooms and pretending to be someone else and interacting with people online, like in this persona, this mask that is actually some shadow version of yourself. And while I was doing that when I was an adolescent, unsurprisingly, there was a lot of music I would have on my headphones while I was chatting with strangers and people I knew in different personas online. And listening to some of that music was a way to touch back into who I was in the past, to touch back into that past self and access it on the page. Music is kind of like a weird time machine.
I have some questions for you. You know, I'm talking about these kids who graduated high school in 1995, which I did myself. It was an easy way to, you know, kind of make sure I was locating it in time and, you know, in a way that made sense. But I made Spotify playlists of specifically the music of 1994, because I'm figuring like they're in the woods in New Hampshire. They're not hearing like the latest releases, right? They've got like one radio station up there. Let's imagine it's like the Dartmouth campus radio station that they can get. So it's like the music of 1994. And that was a trip, because it was not only getting me back into my novel, it was getting me back into my high school head, you know, and really, you know, again and again. And these songs that, in some cases, my characters probably wouldn't have listened to, but that I did in high school. It was pretty fun. I'm definitely going to be releasing a playlist when this one comes out. I'm not sure if I'm going to do this. I saw someone on Twitter recently doing like this thing where if people pre-ordered the book, they'd get this code for this, you know, special Spotify playlist or something, which could be fun, or I could just put the actual playlist on my website. I'm not sure, but I'm going to have fun with it.
Well, this has been a fun conversation. And just a side note, I graduated from high school in 1994, so I was listening to the same music. But I was also in the sticks, so maybe my playlist was more 1992 or 93.
Yeah, I'm kind of jealous of you guys in a weird way. I am about a decade younger, but so much of my band is like 80s, early 90s nostalgia. Well, it was originally conceived of as a kind of like a soundtrack for a non-existent imaginary horror film from the 80s. But I have a lot of nostalgia for a time that I didn't exist in or wasn't a teenager in.
And that is how your band got the name Kill Scenes?
Yeah, it's the kill scenes in a horror film, the scenes where someone gets killed.
Got it. Well, this has been a super fun conversation again. I thank you both for joining me. It's been such a pleasure. Do you have any final thoughts for our audience?
None really. It's kind of cool how this interview is itself a kind of time travel. We are simultaneously in October and February or whenever this is going to come into the world.
Yes. We're doing the time warp again for sure. So yeah, it's been great though. It's been great. Any final thoughts, Rebecca?
God, no, this is so fun. I'm excited to read Megan's book. I'm excited to maybe meet her in person soon. And Courtney, I hope I see you in person soon too.
Yeah. Maybe in Seattle next year.
Oh yeah, AWP. All right. So that'll be after this airs even. We'll say it now and then it'll come true.
Yeah. All right. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Courtney and Rebecca. Bye.
Thank you for listening to PWN's Debut Review. This podcast is hosted by Project Right Now, a nonprofit writing studio. We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. Please follow, rate, and review wherever you listen. And stay tuned because our next debut could be you. PWN's Debut Review is produced by Jennifer Chohan and edited by Adam Wells and Lisa Hartsgrove. The theme song, Don't Look Away, was written and performed by Mimi Cross and produced by Kevin Salem. Questions, comments, suggestions? Email us at debutreview@projectrightnow.org.